What if we could have the food we want to eat at the price we want to pay within reach, which is to say, right here, right now? This thought leads us to ask, how close can technology and innovation get us to our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1371st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Yokohama who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, today it is said that food now travels an average of 1,200 miles from where it was grown to where it is eaten. If one were to look forward 100 years into the future from 100 years in the past, when people lived on farms and ate food they grew themselves, one would think that 1,200-mile food of the future would be an impossibility. How could you possibly eat something from 1,200 miles away? And yet here we are, eating food that travels 1,200 miles to get to our dinner plate. This 1,200-mile food is very convenient for us city people. Just open the plastic container and eat. No spending hours out in the fields and gardens with shovels, rakes, and hoes. Just open and eat, and move on to the more important things we conjure up to do with our time. Wait! According to Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. It is a fact. Those of us who eat 1,200-mile food have very little control over what is or is not in that food. We can only trust the businesses that grow, process, package, ship, store, and sell that food to us to deliver real nutrition. However, we also know that the businesses that sell the least amount of essential nutrients for the most money are the businesses that tend to stay in business. And so we wonder, can the technology and innovation that delivered 1,200 miles food to our plate deliver 1 mile food to our plate? Well, who better to ask than the authors of Proximity, How Coming Breakthroughs in Just-in-Time Transform Business, Society, and Daily Life. Robert Wolcott and Kahan Krippendorf, welcome aboard the Food Chain Radio program.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Okay, Robert, let's start with you. Do a quick background. Adjutant Professor of Innovation at the Booth School of Business, University of Chicago, and Adjunct Professor of Executive Education at the Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. Figure you tell people how better to do business. Is that right?
Well, something like that, Michael. By the way, great to be on your show. I like to think of it more like I work with people who are actually running businesses to try and learn together.
Great. And how to be a better leader and how to maybe innovate, too, as we go along, right? Kahan, you're as the founder of Outthinker Networks, a global think tank comprised of corporate strategists, innovators, and intrapreneurs shaping the future of business. What's an intrapreneur, Kahan?
Oh, an intrapreneur is an entrepreneur that activates inside an existing system, like inside an existing organization. And they have been a primary driver of innovation in society. And so part of our mission is to celebrate them, activate them, and facilitate their innovation.
It seems to me that in looking into the future, the stock that really represents where we might be heading is NVIDIA. And a lot of people must think the same thing because they've boosted the price of NVIDIA for what, $14 to $14 trillion or something like weird like that. It is a huge, huge stock. So my question to both of you, should we buy, sell, or hold NVIDIA?
Well, okay. So I didn't know we were giving investment advice, but I just for some context, Michael, I invest a lot in the venture space, so privately held venture-backed companies. But I also invest in the public markets, and I consider that Barron's my sports page. I really don't care about sports, but boy, I love the public market. So here's my answer for NVIDIA. Look, in the semiconductor space, nobody is even close. They're trying to catch up. There's some other great companies out there, Broadcom, AMD. Nobody's close to NVIDIA and probably won't be for some time. So I'm not giving thanks, but my personal approach is I've got a bunch of NVIDIA stock and I'm not selling it. And I'm going to continue to ride it, at least for the next couple of years.
You're holding then?
For a while, yeah. I mean, if you look at the engineering, the science, the market position, what they're providing, no one's even close at this point. But, you know, I don't know how much you want to get into investment advice here on the show.
Well, to me, what we're talking about is investing in the future. And I think that's really what NVIDIA is pointing to. Kai-Hun, what about you?
Yeah, I've looked at NVIDIA a bit from a strategic perspective. I don't trust myself to try to predict what the market valuations are or should be or will be, but I kind of more like to look at the fundamentals. And I think that NVIDIA's a strategic approach, which is very much geared to an ecosystem approach through partnerships that drive toward like a solving a broader social problem. I think that is one of the reasons that it has been as successful as it is. However, that approach is now being adopted by other companies. So, they have inspired a lot of strategic behavior. And so I think that they're amazing and strong and, as Rob said, way ahead. But I luckily don't have to choose to bet on the future.
Michael, just to bring this back around, NVIDIA, of course, is, as you and all your listeners know, is fundamental to the AI revolution.
Yes.
And AI is not by far not the only technology, but it is a pivotal technology driving proximity. The more we can bring intelligent agency to the extent we give decision-making authority to intelligent agents, AI systems, et cetera, closer to each moment of demand, the more we drive proximity. So those that own AI will own proximity.
That's what I was looking for. Good. Okay. That's almost a buy recommendation then to me.
Almost.
Oh, not quite. Okay, fair enough. Proximity. Well, of course, we all know proximate means close. But what does P equals zero mean?
Yeah, Kai-Hun, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, so P equals zero, we found to be a very helpful concept, which is the hypothetical point in any industry or any business at which the proximity of demand and supply becomes zero. So the moment that a demand emerges, somebody says, I want an apple, in P equals zero, that apple and the value of that apple is created right there in front of them at that moment and not a moment before.
Instant gratification, P equals zero. The proximity is right here.
Yes.
But as Kai-Hun said, Michael, we use P equals zero as a hypothetical construct to think about where we're going across every industry, but it looks very different in different industries. And note that we separate production of value from provision of value. So in many ways, food, especially in wealthy areas, developed countries, et cetera, food is already at hand almost everywhere, anytime. So that's sort of the provision of that food. But as you articulated in your introduction to this program, many times it's produced thousands of miles away. And so the production is not proximate. The provision is, but what we're starting to see, we're at the very beginning of this curve. We're starting to see more and more capabilities bringing the possibility of growing, creating, cultivating, fermenting food, proteins, et cetera, closer and closer where it's actually consumed. And that's the trend of productivity.
Which is bringing that food back home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Making 1,200-mile food, 1-mile food, if possible. That's kind of the instant gratification. If you want the apple, there it is. Is this a new way of looking at business models? I sense that you two are up to something a little bit more developed than, you know, just technology. There seems, yeah, seems to be another element to this equation of P equals zero, yeah, that you're trying to get at. What is it?
Yeah, so, Michael, this is one of the reasons I was so excited to work with Kai on in this, because as you mentioned, he spends his whole career thinking about strategy, thinking about organizations and how they envision and implement strategy. And so what we weren't trying to do is just say, here's some cool stuff that people are doing with technology. That's really neat, but that's not what we're doing. We were actually trying to find foresight as to confidence as to where the world will go and have evidence that it is going that direction. And that's what we have with proximity. So when we articulate proximity, we say digital compel the creation of value ever closer to the moment of actual demand. And what we're not saying is respond faster to customers or be a little bit closer to customers. That's all wonderful stuff. We're literally saying over the rest of our career, the production and provision of products, services, and experiences will trend closer and closer to the moment of actual demand. And so when you realize that proximity is predictive about where the world is definitely going, this is not a, oh, I wonder if, this is where it's going, then you can get ahead of it. You can say, how does our business model, how do our technology platforms need to evolve, need to change in order to lead this proximity revolution and manage, because others are going to do it.
And sell it too. And yep, that'll be the business model of the future, is whoever can get it to us fastest for the best price and the best value will win. And there we go. So that's a substantial leap into the future.
Yeah, I think, I think that kind of the linear concept of an industry that Michael Porter made famous in the 1980s of, you know, production of raw materials, value getting added, and then reaching the end consumer, kind of that comes from a paradigm of taking things and transporting them. What we're proposing is proximity isn't just about shortening that. It's about, I think, reconceptualizing it around the customer and being able to sense when there is need. Now, how does value get created? Value doesn't get created just usually by one supplier, but, you know, that apple is chopped up and mixed with sugar and mixed with dough to make the apple pie, right? So now you have three different players that are collectively creating that. What we're saying is if you start looking at it from individual proximity, you start thinking about those agents or those suppliers as being around the customer. And because they're digitally connected, they're able to coordinate more rapidly and pull together the value closer to that moment in demand. So yeah, it does require a conceptual shift.
Okay.
And Kaihan Black's point was essential. The reason proximity is completely new and different today is there are things we can do today we could never have done before. The proximity, Michael, actually came from a question I asked in 2014, which is what is fundamentally different about digital technologies, meaning all sorts of digital tech, so 3D printing, rooftop solar, AI, mobile app, everything. What is fundamentally different about digital technologies compared to the industrial age? When you look at that, you realize there are things we could do that we could never have done before, and that's where the opportunity and the threat lies.
Well, okay, let's apply that to food. Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Robert Wolcott, Kaihan Krippendorf, co-authors of Proximity, How Coming Breakthroughs in Just-in-Time Transform Business, Society, Daily Life, and Food. Do stay tuned, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, as we opened the show today, we discussed how modern food, you know, is now 1,200-mile food. It comes an average of 1,200 miles from where it was grown to where we eat it. My goodness sakes, those of us who lived 100 years ago would have looked at that and thought, you got to be kidding. You're crazy. And so today we're kind of looking at the technologies that we used to eat 1,200-mile food and see if we can bring that, use that technologies as it has evolved to make one-mile food. And Robert and Kaihan, technology has evolved hugely. It seems like we're going through one transformative new technology a week or something like that. Hard to keep track of it all.
Well, actually, Michael, that's one of the reasons we created Proximity, because it makes sense of things. When you know the trend is to push the production of value ever closer to the moment of demand, then things like AI and how that will impact various industries become a lot more clear. We're going, for instance, from large language models everybody knows about to small language models. They're being distributed all over AI, all over mobile devices, for instance, by Apple. That's something we predict. That's something that you can easily see is going to happen, and now it's happening. And so you can get ahead of these things and make sense of all the dramatic, seemingly chaotic occurrences.
If you have the fundamentals of the religion down, then you can worship, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Sure. If you know the rules, then you can go with it. And the rules are, how would you put the rules in really succinct terms, Kaihan?
There are several rules, but I think maybe the three big ones are moment of use. That is a moving towards producing things only when there is demand. As Rob often says, the easiest demand to predict is the one that is already there. Now, 38% of the food that is grown in the world goes to waste to a great extent because we are not very good at predicting or moving food through the supply chain. So when we move to moment of use, we could have zero food waste, right? Then you also have the digitization of the customer, digitization of the supply chain, digitization of farms through precision farming. And as those three things start getting digitized, think the IoT devices, the sharing of data, and AI that lets us process the data, we start turning that whole supply chain into a digitized supply chain. But the third thing I think is really important is a shift from a kind of customer-centric mindset towards an ecosystem-centric mindset, where we aren't only trying to focus on the customer needs, but also on the grocery store needs, the supplier needs, the grower needs, and actually appreciating that they all play a role in the ecosystem. And when you kind of layer all those together, you start to get this contour, as Rob said, of what it could look like and why people are making seemingly small but incredibly valuable jumps in proximity and where it could be going.
Well, you made a pretty good example of that with respect to your opening story about Beijing duck and COVID. Robert?
Well, yeah, so that's a favorite story of mine. When COVID hit, hired the Chinese appliance manufacturer was thinking, what can we do in this context? And they thought about their customers in China. So many Chinese love Peking duck. And as your listeners might know, if you want to have Peking duck, you generally have to order it in advance and go to a restaurant because it's not something traditionally that people find easy to prepare at home. And so the short version of the story is from the moment that Haier decided to bring this concept to market to the moment when they were in market, for Peking duck enabled, they enabled the ovens, the Haier ovens that were already out in the marketplace. They enabled them with software to prepare Peking duck using ducks that they partnered with, animal, producer. They partnered with them to create ducks and then prepare them appropriately for the oven. They went and got intellectual property rights from various chefs, celebrity chefs. You can go on and select the specific celebrity chef's recipe you want, download it into your Haier oven, and it automates the preparation of that duck. From the moment they had this idea to the moment it was in the market, and they sold 20,000 ducks in December of 2020, was 1 year.
Wow.
So it took them 1 year, but as Kaihan pointed out, it wasn't them by themselves. They're not going to go out and start to grow ducks. They're not going to go out and come up with recipe. They had to bring an ecosystem of partners together and coordinate them. And then that created a proximate experience during lockdown for their customers to enjoy a delicacy they could only have enjoyed mostly in a restaurant before. So that's a great example of proximity that happened very quickly from an established enterprise.
So they took the oven, which is kind of comparable to any machine, and it was a smart oven because it can be programmed, kind of like a Tesla car that can be programmed to drive you home at night without you doing anything. It's amazing. Now they reprogrammed the ovens to cook the Beijing duck just right. Then they had to get ducks, and so they coordinated that with a duck farm of some kind and a duck processor because you have to process the ducks. So you bring all of this together in a just-in-time situation where a person can order a duck and have it show up at their house, and then they can press a button and get their choice of Beijing duck recipes, of which there must be many. And then they put the duck in the oven with the sauce, and there it is, Beijing duck.
And to underscore that, Michael, that was not possible before the automated oven. Very few of us. We didn't grow up with automated ovens at home, but now increasingly we do have automated ovens. And when you have those digital capabilities distributed all over the economy, ever closer to each one of us in our daily lives, more and more becomes possible. And that's the promise of proximity.
And as Kahan said, one of the principal elements involved is digitization, which takes us back to, of course, NVIDIA and its super tool that it brought to the world. And artificial intelligence. We haven't even gotten to artificial intelligence yet with respect to the food chain, have we?
That's true. And you know, artificial intelligence has the capability to remove a lot of waste from the food chain. Why does that apple sit on a truck? It pulls up at the supermarket and the supermarket isn't ready for it, so it ages. And then the supermarket has it in the back storage room, but it's not out on display because they didn't realize that they were about to sell out. They can't predict how many people are going to buy apples on Thursday, and should they cut them up into a fruit salad instead? So there are all of these inefficiencies, well, I would say inability to accurately predict what is going to be needed. And when you've multiplied that across the whole supply chain, AI allows us to be much better at predicting that and removing a lot of that waste and getting the food more quickly through the supply chain.
In proximity, you used a wonderful story about a Coke machine.
Oh, about, I think it was MIT students, right?
Right.
The freestyle?
Yeah, well, no, this is even before that. I remember the story about the MIT students.
Oh, right.
They would walk a long way. You know, grad students, they have limited time and money, and they don't like effort like walking, you know? So they'd have to walk a long way to the commissary and then find that the Coke machine was empty. So they said it didn't have what they wanted. So they said, you know what? Let's create a sensor system that tells me remotely whether the Coke's in the machine or not. And they just did that for their own uses. But, you know, fast forward to today, you've got your freestyle machine at the Fuddruckers, and you can go in and make your own cherry Coke, Diet Coke for some horrible combination that only you love, that no one would ever plan and send out into their channels, but you love it, you make it. That's a level of customization, and proximity allows us to customize in ways we could never have done before. It allows us, for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, to break the trade-off between customization and efficiency, or customization and cost. And by the way, Michael, I know this is a show about food. Not only can you do this now with sodas and a freestyle machine, but the same technology has been applied to doing this with pharmaceutical drugs, where the system sits there doing absolutely nothing with raw materials, waiting until the doctor says, I need 1,000 doses of atropine. And a few hours later, out come 1,000 doses of atropine or ciprofloxacin or a statin or whatever the product happened to.
Print on demand.
Print on demand drugs. That's right. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, you know, you talk about the conflicting objectives here of our food chain, efficient scale versus sustainability and resilience, and access to food versus nutrition and quality. They seem to be competing demands on our food chain. How do you see this proximity technology and innovation changing that, resolving those conflicts?
Well, I'll give a punchline, and then Kion, I know you have some examples, but a critical thing we learned from the research for the book was the key to proximate agriculture is proximate power, sustainable, reliable, low-cost power. The more we can get power proximate to where it's required and in sustainable, reliable, affordable ways, the more we can have distributed agriculture. So to give you an example, the largest vertical farm in operation today is in Dubai, a company called Bustanica, was originally a partnership with Emirates Airlines. And Bustanica grows phenomenal lettuces, herbs, miles from the Dubai airport. So Emirates was obviously doing this to supply their flight. And the exciting part, I visited there in December of 2022. The exciting part was I tried these wonderful leafy greens, was as good as anything you'd find at a French farmer's market. But the exciting part was the next morning, when I got on my flight from Dubai back to New York City, the lettuce in my salad was picked at that facility the night before. Mm-hmm. So now when you compare that to the existing model of growing leafy greens in Spain and harvesting them in advance, putting them on a ship, putting them into a warehouse, hopefully you've done your demand planning properly. You waste a whole bunch of it, as Kion pointed out. Compare the overall system economics of that to growing only what you need, where and when you need it, with 98% less water and very, very high quality. You realize that this is a game changer. And so to underscore that, Emirates Airlines bought all of Bustanica this year. So they own the whole thing. Now, the key to making that scalable in other places, to bringing fresh produce anywhere, anytime, is available, affordable, sustainable energy. And as that problem becomes solved, then the possibilities of agriculture multiply. Mm-hmm. Kion, you looked at a number of these sorts of models. Give us an example.
You overlay that proximate energy on top of technology just to greater proximate production. Whether that is controlled environment farming and advances in controlling light and nutrients to robotics and dark factories, it changed the economic, where there has always been this pull, push, this tug of war between inexpensive but mass and more expensive but local. Now the equation, I don't think it equates out, but it starts pulling more towards proximity because the cost of providing customization comes down. You know, Miele, the appliance manufacturer, has a whole line of things that look like appliances, that look like a refrigerator or a beverage refrigerator, but it's a vertical farm in your kitchen. So there is advances that allow us to now grow closer. Now on the demand side, what we call the personalization premium increases, right? We know that people are interested in more functional food. They care more about ingredient transparency. They want more sustainable. They want more resilient supply. So all of these things will increase the willingness to pay for more proximate food. So the two sides of the equation are moving in the direction of that tug of war getting pulled more and more towards proximity. And so hopefully, I hope, we're going to see fewer really large, distant farms that are growing just one type of crop.
Goldilocks future. What do you mean by that?
Well, anything, anywhere, anytime, not too cold, not too hot. Now, just to build on that metaphor, Michael, though, it's important to note that Kion and I are not proposing in proximity that this is nirvana. We are definitely not saying everything's going to be great. Look, humans have shown our inability to make great decisions when faced with abundance. I mean, look at all the challenges we face. But what we are saying is there are things that are possible today and will be in the future that were never possible before. And so we need to think about what are we trying to optimize for? In my ideal future, and I think probably in yours as well, Michael, we want to have healthy, fresh food and a variety of it available for anyone in the world, anytime, anywhere. And that's a North Star. We're not going to get there immediately. It's going to take a long time.
But this is the direction that we're going, and it becomes possible because of all these sorts of digital and digitally enabled technology.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about proximate agriculture, proximate food, bringing our food back home from that 1,200-mile drive from where it was grown to where we now eat it. There has to be a better way, and that's what we're talking about, a proximate way. And we're doing so with two people who've written a book called Proximity, Robert Walcott and Kyan Krippendorf. And when we come back, we're going to pick up this thread and talk about how it is becoming manifest today for our food. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
You know, back in the year 1900, there were 400 million people living in China, and they were all fed by farmers who, for the most part, had a half an acre of land. And that land was really close to where people ate the food. Today, most of those people who knew how to grow food on those very intensive small parcels of land have moved into the city and are making widgets in factories. And the knowledge of how to do that is being lost. Or is it? Now, I just heard in this great story about how in Singapore, I think it was in your book, yeah. As of 2022, the Singapore Food Agency reports some local farmers are producing 10 to 15 times more per acre than traditional farms. It's only beginning of the country's ambitions for a sustainable, resilient local supply. As I look at this place from standing on top of a hill and looking way down in the valley, it seems as though we're going back to that those technologies of farmers of 40 centuries that F.H. King wrote about so long ago, and adopting our modern technologies to bring that food home. Robert?
Well, you can kind of look at it like that, but it's sort of in a space-age sci-fi version of it. You know, one of the
we don't have to carry the manure pails, right?
Well, the nice thing, Michael, is if you want to do that, that's certainly your prerogative. It's good to live in a free country. So, but my point is you take all the knowledge, all the insight of not only traditional farming, but also science and the modern advances in agriculture, and you take the advances in digital technologies and AI, et cetera, and you can dramatically amplify yield, and you can distribute production in smaller footprints and still have efficiency, in fact, even have greater efficiency. So to give an example, you mentioned Singapore. That's a fantastic example because the government has made it a national priority to be able, they've set their objective. We need to be able to produce a third of all of our nutrition here inside Singapore by 2030. Now think about this. Singapore is a city state. It's a very small landmass. And their aspiration is to have a third, I think 30% of their food produced in country by 2030. You're not going to get there with traditional technologies. We're not even going to get there with the most modern at scale farming technology. We're going to have to do some things dramatically differently. So to give you an example, Jeff Bezos just announced he's making a week or two ago, he's making a $30 million donation to the National University of Singapore to drive breakthroughs in sustainable protein, and in particular, things like cultivated meat. So there are certainly alternative proteins, insect proteins. You can grow in very small footprints. And insect proteins, as you know, are already essential for animal husbandry, but also in some countries like Thailand and Mexico, people consume them for nutrition. But in addition to that, we have things called cultivated meat.
So I think Jeff Bezos is very big in that industry, too.
Very big, yeah. Very big. And we talk about this in the book. I visited in early 2023, I visited a company, LF Farms in Tel Aviv, and they're a leader in developing cultivated meat. And this is not a meat substitute. This is actual meat, mustard that's grown in basically a laboratory or a small footprint farm. Now, it's still very expensive. There are a lot of engineering challenges to overcome, but look, they're engineering challenges. They're not laws of physics. we're going to overcome these engineering challenges. And think about what this means. Imagine if you could take a facility the size of a large condominium and put meat production in that to serve that local area, and to do so in a customized base, the exact kinds of meat, muscle tissue that specific customers, chefs, et cetera, desire for that local population. Compare that to the current model. If I want to grow beef, I got to grow cows. I've got to go get thousands of acres of land. I've got to raise the cows. I've got to put them on trains and trucks and cart them for slaughter. And, you know, not to mention the ethical challenges that we all face as a result. Transition that to no animals involved at all in the production of actual meat. Again, it's still early, but this is where we're going. And then you have proximate meat production closer and closer to the moment demand, less and less weight, lower and lower costs from an environmental and eventually a cost perspective to scale these kinds of capabilities.
Print on demand meat. It's kind of like we're going to be living on a spaceship someplace and just need the raw materials that we can put in a big tank and press a button on the computer, and out comes a filet mignon.
Yeah. There you go. Well, you know, that's the replicator from Star Trek, Michael.
Right, right. Now, a real world example of that right here in the Monterey Bay Area with Driscoll Strawberries. Growing strawberries has traditionally been a job for gypsies because you can't keep a strawberry plant in the ground very long before the soil organisms start eating up the roots and you have to do something. So first thing they did was use methyl bromide and killed everything in the soil with this gas. Everybody said, no, you can't do that anymore. So they come up with other gases that do pretty much the same thing. But, and then the other thing that growing strawberries requires is stoop labor. You have to bend way over to get the strawberries way down there on the ground. So these are two real tough things to come to grips with in growing strawberries. Now, what Driscoll is really working on, as we understand, is the vertical farming where they can grow strawberries in the city down the street from you so that, as you suggest, you can have a strawberry delivered from the farm to your house by maybe Uber, who knows? And that's where we're going, isn't it?
That's a real company, a real brand, experimenting with this technology, trying to get out front of proximity. And that's the kind of company that I like to bet on.
Not only out front, but out from under significant production obstacles.
And the industry norms and regulations and history and habits of the industry.
Yeah, all
a lot of
those
it
things
technically already feasible. And that's what we were doing the research. We were really surprised that a lot of this already exists. It is less a technical challenge than it is a combinatorial challenge of combining the technology and a mindset challenge and getting people to kind of forget old ways and explore new ways. Yeah.
While keeping their taste for good food.
Yeah.
There you go. Now, it does seem to me like we're building systems designed to provide us food in what could be considered unnatural environments, like a spaceship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that where proximity food is going to take us?
Well, actually, Michael, the last chapter you're alluding to is about virtual reality and space. These are the two horizons of the 21st century. Humanity has never really been in either of those places, and we're going there. We're definitely going there as a century. And one of the exciting things about space is before COVID, I was sharing proximity with a good friend of mine, Dorit Denobiel. She's a professor of space health at Baylor. And by the way, that's a really cool title, professor of space health. And when
there's a lot of people in Santa Cruz that would claim that too.
Yeah, they probably have that title. I'm quite sure. But when I was explaining this to her, she said, wait a minute, Rob, all the research going on around the world right now, to try and figure out how to help humans thrive in space is driving proximity. Why is that? Well, because when you're on a spaceship for 7 months to Mars, you've only got what's on the spaceship. So it doesn't matter what it is. You can't call Amazon because you forgot something, at least not yet. So that'll come. So you've got to be able to do, be anything you want on that spaceship during that period of time. And so naturally, research that's going on right now to enable people to be in space is coming back to Earth and having impact. So a very quick example, one of the companies I've invested in, Interstellar Lab, they're just outside Paris, a great French venture capitalist, food scientist, Barbara Belvisi, founded it. She started with a grant from NASA. And the question was, how do we grow food on Mars? That was the challenge. They've made a ton of progress. In fact, just recently, a few weeks ago, Interstellar Lab won a big award, a $1 million award from NASA, selected amongst 300 different companies and research groups in the world to be the leading contender to provide food production, food growing system on spaceship. And meanwhile, she's brought this technology back to production of various products here on Earth. She and her team are producing things for L'Oreal, for Firmenich, companies like this that need ingredients for cosmetics, skincare, things like this. But they're growing them in pods in the factory where every bit of the environment, the nutrition, the water, et cetera, is optimized for each individual plant. And the yields are already 1,000, 2,000, 3,000% higher than in the wild. And those companies have zero supply chain challenges. So when they have that production of that critical ingredient right there in their factory, they don't care about geopolitics. They don't care what's going on in the Red Sea. They've got what they need when they need it. And that's quintessential proximity.
It seems as though this technology is progressing toward the same point from different ends of the spectrum. You have people like Driscoll's who have to deal with these problems about growing strawberries. So they come up, well, why don't we just do some vertical farms in a warehouse in Washington, D.C. and sell the strawberries, and you don't have to bend over. They just come to you and you just pluck them.
And you don't have to ship them 1,200 miles,
yes,
as you said earlier,
no,
Michael.
12, no, 1 mile food is what they get. Yeah. Now, that's from the practical side, from the ground side, progressing forward. And then you have these people who, like you suggested in Paris, who are working from outer space, from total sealed environments down toward Earth. So it seems like this technology is progressing from two different directions toward proximity.
Yep. 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 I think, yeah. I mean, And space has a long history of bringing us proximate technologies. You've got a cordless power tools, for example, invented for use in space, insulin pumps, LED lighting. These technologies that today are just kind of everyday available for us, they were invented in part because of the need for proximity in space.
And let's not forget Tang.
Tang and
ice cream. Not that that's any good. But
well, you know, if we lived 100 years ago and looked forward 100 years to what we're eating today, we would be totally blown away, I'm certain, by the fact that we're eating food that comes from 1,200 miles away. We would scratch our head and say, boy, that's really miraculous. I don't have to hang around the garden all day with a hoe and a shovel. I can just unpeel this plastic thing and there's my food. Well, gentlemen, take us to 100 years from today. How are we going to be eating?
Oh, wow. 100 years, Michael. Boy, you've opened a can of worms or maybe a can of food. Who knows? Well, one thing I'm quite sure we'll be doing.
Well, do you think it'll be in a can? In 100 years from now?
No, probably not. Probably not. But one thing, there's so many directions we could go with this, but one thing I'm rather confident will happen unless we blow ourselves up. You know, that's always a possibility. But one thing that I'm quite confident will happen is healthcare and food merging, converging. And as we learn more and more about our gut biome, for instance, our genomic, proteome, et cetera, we'll be able to more and more customize what's best for Kaihan, what's best for Michael. And we'll end up with food that is ideally suited, nutrition that's ideally suited for each of us. And if you really want to get crazy, Michael, as virtual reality becomes better and better and eventually indistinguishable from real world, quote unquote, then we'll actually decouple the need for physical nutrition from the culinary experience, because then we'll be able to have virtual, and we do mean this literally, virtual culinary and social experiences in virtual space that have no food involved at all. It's all simulated. Now, we don't have, probably on this show, have time to go into those crazy details, but in the book, in our last chapter, we refer to this as the post-virtual world. And so if anybody's interested in it, it's the next horizon. I'm going to spend a lot of time on this concept of post-virtual in the next couple of years. So please, I encourage your listeners to reach out on LinkedIn. I'm always on LinkedIn and love to explore this post-virtual world even more.
And how do they get there?
How do we get to post-virtual world?
Yes. Post-virtual world. How do we get to a post-virtual world? We have 1 minute.
Okay, 1 minute. Post-virtual is defined as the point after which you cannot tell the difference experientially between virtual reality and default or real reality. Then we will be in the post-virtual world, because no one will ask a stupid question like, Michael, should we meet at that real cafe or the fake cafe? There won't be a difference. That question won't make any sense. The main way we get there, brain-computer interfaces such as being worked on by Elon Musk and his teams and many other teams, brain-machine interfaces. It's still early. It's still a mess. But you asked for years
there
from
it
now,
is.
That's what we'll be doing.
Robert Walcott, Kaihan Krippendorf, the book Proximity: How Coming Breakthroughs in Just-in-Time Transform Business, Society, and Daily Life. Will they need people? Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.